Around the NFL Podcast was rated 78 by PFF.
Welcome to another edition of the Around the NFL Podcast. My name is Dan Hansis, and I'm joined in a room filled with heroes, Mark Sessler, Chris Wessling, and Greg Rosenthal. What is up, boys?
Hey, Dan.
Welcome to the Thursday show. We're now exactly 2 weeks away from the NFL draft. How about that?
What was it that you were saying to me as our mics were cut? You defamed me as we were going about to enter the show, and I did not hear the insult.
I did not defame you, but every once in a while when we are in the studio, Mark is a little impatient when we're doing too much chattering before because you're trying to get home or out of here. And I had a bit that I was saying what you were actually going to, because you told us you were going home because you had to do chores. None of us believe you. So there's something, you're doing something after the show today. I had a bit, but I can't say it on air because it's
my current life cannot be more dull, so I have no other plan to hatch. It is 10:57, and we were supposed to start the pod at 10 a.m.
Well, we had some things we had to do.
Yeah, we're going to start at 10:40. It is 10:58.
I mean, if you want to see this...
I know that Wes agrees with me.
Light attitude from Mark. You can check out Up to the Minute on Friday. Our hit will likely be around 11:45.
There you go.
Drop what you're doing at your job and go run to a local tavern where it's on with no sound.
I don't know. I do agree with you, but only because... in the 7 years of this podcast, or 6 years, it has never once started on time.
Well, we would have had, yeah. Well, you're right.
There's a lot of complaining for delays that were done to ensure the podcast was better today. That's what it's about.
I am not complaining. I'm just pointing out a fact.
That's what I'm doing also, simply operating in facts. Clock time.
All right.
No one loves chores more than Mark. That's what I'm doing
no
today.
There are no
chores. Come do these chores.
All right. Today's show. Got a good one. 2 weeks from the draft, and mentioned this on the Twitter show in passing during a segment we did, and you could check out our Twitter show. I think I have it pinned on the top of my Twitter profile if you want to get it there. It's a good show. You're on the
NFL
Twitter show we do every Wednesday. But I said how if you could throw one thing into the black hole, it is – this period of the calendar, which just seems excessive and unnecessary. I fleshed it out a little bit just to, if any shadowy league figures are listening. In fact, I'm going to pound on some tables and go upstairs with this because I think this works. And let me know if you agree. So Super Bowl, first Sunday in February, fine. Combine, last week in February, first week of March, fine. Mid-March, free agency, the new league year, fine. So far, everything's okay. Now we get into trouble, all right? So the owners' meetings at the end of March, that's fine. But what I want to do there is build in a GM ice cream social that same weekend. And these guys can really get in the room together, you know, have some desserts and work out different deals and have the conversations that you need ahead of the draft. During this time, all the pro days, they have to be done by March 1st. So let's not drag out the pro day process.
Thank you.
And after your ice cream social, the next week, the first Thursday of April is the draft. Who says no? Just condense this stuff. Open up the spring a little bit.
Nobody that cares about quality of life would say no.
I think that's an improvement. But I also think the suggestions in the past that they – and I think a lot of people inside the league would agree with this – that you put the draft before free agency is intriguing. That you do the combine, and then you do the draft right after that, basically. You do the draft where free agency would be now, or maybe even a week before, and then you do free agency after that. It'd be a whole different way to build teams, but other leagues do this. The WNBA had their draft like a day after the NCAA tournament, and the NBA essentially does the same thing where they do it immediately after the NBA season ends. They have the draft the next week.
I mean, it's great for us. It's like the NFL, which is overtly attempting to stretch the calendar out to the point where there's no free months at all. But every coach at the combine's like, I haven't even had a second to look at tape. Don't even ask me about quarterback X. So you're truncating and compacting their schedule.
They'll
they may be the
out.
Ones who
They'll
don't like it.
It
and well, then, that's easy to say.
As we continue to learn, they all lie. They got time. They're watching. Even if they say, I haven't had time to even look at the tape, they've been pouring through all this tape. It's all lies. What did DJ say, especially this 2 week period?
It's all a lie.
It's all a lie. And now I'm starting to learn about the business almost 10 years in. Everything is lies at all times. And you got to parse that. That's why I have Chris Wessling here.
I remember when Andy Reid stood up there and said over and over again, I am not trading Donovan McNabb. Mm. Then like 2 days later, traded Donovan. I mean, it's all lies.
All right. Here we go. Today's show.
Sorry, children out here. We're really, you know, disabusing you of your optimism at a young age.
It's true. If
we're actually pretty big in the 8 to 10 year old demographic. Surprisingly,
we destroy that demographic.
The little kids love it.
Defend football for a second. I mean, the number of lies is minuscule compared to, let's say, the arena of politics.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So fair. You know,
and they're mostly white lies.
It's all relative.
This running back, we're not letting go of him. Like, that's fine. If you do, the world continues to operate.
That's fair. Hey, general managers, yes, they lie. Sometimes it's lies of omission. Sometimes it's just straight up lies. And I don't know if you factor in their ability to tell the truth or willingness to tell the truth in the general manager power rankings, but we're going to do it today. We're going to put the general managers of the NFL into different groups and break down who's cutting the mustard and who's the opposite of what cutting the mustard is.
I wonder where that came from. Seems weird that you cut mustard.
Yeah, very strange. And, of course, we're going to do some news. Let's start there. And, yes, let's start, speaking of the Twitter show, with some news that we broke in the NFL world, the Cognoscenti. Let's hit it, Ricky.
I mean, if you're quitting bagels, you might as well be quitting life. Live a little.
I can't disagree with you there, Greg.
I mean, you should eat what you want in life.
Overrated food.
You know, maybe don't, you know, just eat with some nice portion control, and then you can eat whatever you want. Eat bad food all the time.
All right, let me say, because you and I have two very different body types, that some people can eat what they want, and even if you do some portion control, it just doesn't work the same way. But I think, to your point, don't have two bagels a week or a day. Have one.
Right. We're not talking about like a double cheeseburger with bacon on it. It's a bagel. It's bread. It's carbo. It fills you up. It's carbo. It's fine. Like, you need that for your life.
Bagels are the food that work at any time of the day, in my opinion.
Except when you don't want to overchew your food.
It's the thing I miss the most about New York is the bagels. Because you can even find a good slice of pizza in L.A. It's not easy, but you can find it. Bagels.
I would like you to come to New York Bagels on Wilshire in 22nd and just check it out.
Been there. Good shop.
Writing it down. Wilshire in 22nd. Hang on. Wilshire 22nd.
I'll pop over there on a Sunday morning about 7:50. Don't, you know, sort of in my pajamas. And I'm back at my, you know.
Just a treat to everyone else.
A park in my home.
Your metabolism, you know, just going
my thought
crazy.
Would, I could drive there and be back with the bagels in like 11 minutes total.
I think I accidentally dropped an F-bomb there, Ricky. So yeah, I
was,
clean that
it was
up.
Only like 40% of an F-bomb.
All right, let's get into the news. We didn't break the news. Sorry, I just want to be clear. Mike Garafolo, our friend, NFL Network's own, Mike Garafolo, an East Coast guy. He was on our Around the NFL Twitter show on Wednesday. The subject of Josh Rosen and his future came up. Rosen, who did report to workouts, voluntary workouts with the Cardinals, but seems like his days are numbered in Arizona with Kyler Murray on the way. I asked Mike during the show if he buys into the reports out there that the Washington Redskins are a likely or potential landing spot for Rosen. Here's what Mike said.
No, that's not true. I heard that myself. They have done a little bit of homework here, or at least tried to figure out what the Cardinals' price would be, but they're not actively chasing him. And I don't know that they have a hard offer on the table, because I know for a fact that they are still going through the motions with the guys in the draft currently, and that they've had made no firm decision about, are we going to draft a guy or are we going to go the Josh Rosen route or try to trade for somebody. I don't sense it. Everything that I've been told, I asked Ian Rappaport about this yesterday. We briefly touched about it on his podcast. He's hearing the same thing. So I don't really believe that it's a sizzling market for Josh Rosen.
Mike made a point too, Greg, that I thought was a good one, that there is talk, well, keep them both on the roster. And that does, there's definitely logic to that. Keep them both on the roster and then trade Rosen down the line. is his value actually going to get better once you bury him on the bench for a month or a year or whatever it is? This probably is, if you want to get the best value, it's probably in the next 3 months or so, I'd say.
Could be. He made the point that a team that suffers an injury isn't going to be looking to a second-year quarterback to take over. They would rather a replacement-level veteran, which that makes some sense. And it makes sense that the Redskins need to go through these rookie quarterbacks to evaluate Rosen versus them. Because if they like a quarterback that they can take, let's say, with their second – they think they'll be able to take with their second-round pick, and they like him better than Josh Rosen, then that's what you do. Or even maybe their first-round pick.
If they liked him enough – they would suspend their due diligence and trade for him now. But they are not overwhelmed, obviously, by what Josh Rosen put on tape last
year. I think
the
difference, too, is with the draftable quarterbacks, and Gruden has said, look, if we're taking someone at 15, he's not a project. He starts right away. He's like, there's a lot of veterans on this team that aren't going to use the year 2038 to win. They're going to start right away. And they have a chance to meet and get to know every one of these quarterbacks. And he talked about grilling them hard on third down situations, all sorts of whiteboard stuff. Josh Rosen, because I don't think they did a ton of homework on Josh Rosen last year after trading for Alex Smith. You're having to bring in a guy who is a polarizing figure. We might like him, but there are a ton of GMs and coaches in the NFL that are scared of the Josh Rosen experience based on various anecdotes and reports, and I don't know if that's a perfect fit for Jay Gruden.
We've never seen Jay Gruden try to develop a guy. I mean, the closest he's come to it is Colt McCoy, and Colt McCoy played elsewhere first.
Didn't he develop Cousins?
He did, but he didn't draft him. I mean, that wasn't his choice. That was Kyle Shanahan's guy. And yeah, he did develop him. I guess I mean a guy where, hey, we're going to choose a Redskins quarterback, and hopefully he can be the future of the position. They've never had that.
Moving on, the Giants continue to move on in a post-Odell Beckham world. The Giants are in the process of finalizing a four-year, $41 million extension with Sterling Shepard. Mike Garofolo reported the deal would make Shepard the team's highest-paid wide receiver. Of course, Golden Tate also joined the Giants in free agency, so that is the 1-2 punch there at wide receiver. Shepard, Wes, has never had a 1,000-yard season, and yes, quarterback play and injuries have held him back. But this is, to me, this is a good signing. It's a nice salary for the guy that hasn't done a lot, but I think there's upside there with Sterling Shepard.
I mean, you could look at it like he basically got the Adam Humphries deal. Slot receiver for the Titans got 4 years, $40 million around there. And Sterling Shepard, to me, is a better receiver. He's sort of a high-end number two, not quite a number one, and I think the contract reflects that.
I think he's underrated, or maybe not underrated, because I think people respect him. But he's a better player than his numbers indicate. I think this was a very good value for the Giants in terms of the money that they got, because I think if he was a free agent or you got to next year, and he's probably going to have a big season in terms of volume, he would cost a lot more.
I mean, their third wideout right now is Corey Coleman. So it's not as if the need has been entirely washed over.
Right.
You got to keep finding.
And I saw some criticism. I guess some people are down on Shepard, like he's not even as good as some other wide receivers who got similar money. I disagree. I think this is actually a good value. And I'm not worried about Golden Tate and him being duplicative. Yes, they're both better on the inside than outside, but you're not making your 3 to 4 year plan around Golden Tate.
And I think we all like Evan Engram too. And of course the running back is special. So there is talent in place on the offensive side of the ball. They just need to address the quarterback.
But it was there last year, too. It's just less this time around.
Moving on. Following up on the Bleacher Report bombshell around Aaron Rodgers and Mike McCarthy. Rodgers spoke on the radio since the last time we did a podcast, but then he was at voluntary workouts with the Packers this week. And he elaborated on his comments in the initial response to the article, which he called, by the way, a smear attack. Here's what Aaron Rodgers said on Wednesday.
Well, first of all, I stand by everything I said, and I just kind of want to refer to that as far as any other comments go. I said it on the show, and I meant it. It has been a great week. I've heard from, 100-plus former teammates and coaches and current teammates and coaches, and that's fun, especially some of the guys you haven't heard from in a while checking in and encouraging you.
And let me just throw out his comments or part of his comments for, to ESPN Milwaukee, the radio station. The thing is about this article, it's not a mystery. This was a smear attack by a writer looking to advance his career, talking with mostly irrelevant, bitter players who all have an agenda. Rather, they're advancing their own careers or just trying to stir old stuff up. Then what happens is the same tired media folks picking it up and talking about it. Mm. It's just emphasizing their opinion about me already.
I think it's valid for him to push back on it, but I was most interested in the places that he and then Mark Murphy, the president, pushed back. They were strongest about saying that the conversation between Murphy and Rogers, where Murphy, the president, told him, don't be the problem. They were so adamant that that didn't happen. Where to the point, like, that's how when people are denying things, like, you kind of look like, how hard are they denying some of these things? The smear attack stuff, that doesn't hold water for me. He's used this attack before. That's not what's going on. I get that Greg Jennings and Jermichael Finley are basically enemies of Aaron Rodgers who are trying to bury him. And I think when you're reading that, you have to take that into account. But they weren't the only two people talking in it. But when they talked about the Murphy-Rodgers conversation, and they're so hard against it, they kind of convinced me, okay, maybe that part of the equation did not happen that way. And that was one of the more interesting parts of the story.
Nothing about, like, Tyler Dunn or what we know about him suggests a guy who's writing smear attacks.
No.
And it was too – the research was too wide, and what he put it in the picture he painted was too convincing. I do think, though, if you're Aaron Rodgers, it is fair to be annoyed by what are repeated – if it's a minority, it is a repeat incident of certain players – bashing him over and over. And if you're him, it is encouraging to hear from 100+ people that say, we know he, there is no way to have one overall opinion of Aaron Rodgers that everyone must agree to. He's a guy that generates different reactions for different reasons. And I don't have a problem with a starting quarterback rubbing a couple starters the wrong way over the course of his career.
I was sorry I missed this discussion the first time around because it reminded me so much of reading The Jordan Rules, the book by Sam Smith that came out in the early 90s with all the teammates talking about Jordan. And Jermichael Finley playing the Horace Grant role where the personalities just clash.
Yep.
He said that Aaron Rodgers is like an addict. And I got to thinking, what is he addicted to? It's sort of the hyper-competitive stubbornness and ego when you're invested so heavily that a lot of great athletes have. It's a byproduct of that competition addiction. And it's hard to put up with ineptitude when you're so invested. I think actually Antonio Brown has some of this in him. But I think, like Mark Murphy says, this is a positive for Aaron Rodgers. And that's why I see it as a positive, because he's out to prove to everyone this year he's not the problem in Green Bay.
Well, and there's multiple ways to kind of look at all of these issues. For instance, Mark Tauscher, who did this interview, it's kind of his home base weekly radio spot that he's done with Jason Wilde forever, Aaron Rodgers. So it's kind of just interesting how you play the media these days, that, okay, I'm going to make my statements on my home base station and then refer the actual questions to report that from everyone else to those statements, which I think is fair to look at as not cowardly, but it's convenient. You know, you're not really answering the questions that are out there. And Rodgers has a long history of instilling fear in the reporters and maybe teammates around him that he'll kind of strike back at you if you don't like the way that he's talking.
And one more Rodgers note, he revealed on that radio show that his leg injury suffered in week one, that Sunday night opener, was more serious than perhaps was reported. In addition to a sprained knee, an MCL sprain, he had a tibial plateau fracture, which, if that sounds familiar, that is the same injury that ended J.J. Watt's season back in 2017, costing him the final 3 months. Now, some people then will say, well, he's making excuses because he didn't have the best year. All right, your mileage may depend on this one. But if it's true, and I don't imagine he's lying about the injury, it might give you a little more insight why Rodgers did not have a Rodgers-like season, because that
is a serious injury.
And played
very carefully. He did some good things.
If he was going to make excuses, he'd have done it during the season. He played through that. Give him credit for it.
I do want to say one last thing, because I do think this whole thing's fascinating. And this is in defense of Tyler Dunn, too. The article was mostly about the toxic relationship between Mike McCarthy and Aaron Rodgers. And when you listened and read between the lines of what Rodgers said on this radio station, he was not nearly as adamant pushing back against that. He brought up some little facts, like, why would I have resigned and this and that? But I think the point was that their relationship ultimately undermined the Packers. He did not push back against that, and that's the part of the story I believe and I think held a lot of weight.
He pushed back too hard, just like Jordan did about the Jordan rules, because it ultimately showed a flawed human being, which we all are. And people understand that about Aaron Rodgers and Michael Jordan.
Meanwhile, on the throne of ease, the Patriots are in a post-Gronk world, and they made a move this week. They signed Austin Seferian Jenkins to a one-year vet minimum contract, Rap Sheet reported. Of course, the last time you heard about ASJ, he was the starting tight end of the Greybeards, so I bid him adieu. I view him as a player with still upside, and he'll probably have roughly 1,200 yards on the Patriots this season, if that's how it works. Yes, the Dwayne Allen released as well by the Patriots offseason, so they have a wide-open tight end room, and ASJ enters the pole position as their top guy. I don't know if he'll stay there.
I think if their goal was to find someone who reminded them of the November Gronk, who Dan decided was washed up, they found the right guy.
Well, not really, because he's not a blocker at all. Like, he's just a
receiver. A big, huge tight end who is theoretically a blocker and can't really move well enough to be a huge threat as a receiver.
He's had some moments. I mean,
he doesn't move well.
I'm not criticizing the rundown in any way, but I cringed when I saw they signed Seferian Jenkins as Gronk replacement. I was like, oh my gosh. I mean, he's not a Gronk replacement.
Okay, then Matt LaCoste is the Gronk replacement.
I mean,
somebody's got to replace him.
He got $50,000 signing bonus, so that usually means you're almost unlikely to make the team. They're going to draft someone, I hope. And then I think Seferian Jenkins might be a nice little upside guy as a number two.
I heard that little arrow, Wes. Gronk was mostly washed up last year. He put it together because he's an all-time great and had a couple
good games. Put it together because he got healthy. He was washed up when he was playing through a high ankle sprain.
He's getting out at the right time. It's finished, Wes. Finish.
What I saw in January, the guy could definitely still play.
He got them a sixth Super Bowl. Gronk did it.
Oh, you're a Patriots fan again now.
Oh, I'm always a fan.
I mean, it's
this
been
era.
Shifting endlessly over the last couple.
I said once Belichick is gone, so we're still well into it.
Fair.
Steven Gostkowski also re-signed with the Patriots, putting an end to the most boring saga of the offseason. Will the Patriots retain their kicker? And they have. Good for them.
I looked at their roster and I thought, if Jason Garrett was the coach, how many wins would you give the Patriots? Tom Brady's still the quarterback.
I would give
That's
them
a good question.
11 wins.
Nine.
Stop.
I'd put the over under at 8.5.
One last Patriot note. A Chiefs fan was cited for shining a laser pointer at Tom Brady in the AFC title game. He was a 64-year-old man.
Oh, come on.
Grow up, Peter Pan. 64. And you're at a football game shining a laser light into the eyes of a
quarterback. I mean, it only makes sense that he's older because that was a very popular classroom trick like in the late 80s and early 90s.
I remember people would take it to the movie theater, too, and it's like, bro, what are you getting out of this? Getting
Thank
your rocks
you.
Off?
Right.
It's not a
what
greater
are you
good
getting
prank.
Out of this?
No.
It's amazing what he was able to overcome in that game. He really put it together. Eric and I remember watching it up here at the end together. It was a beautiful moment.
Finally, so you are a Patriots fan. That's good.
I was. I am. I said through the Belichick era. It's not like I'm dropping off.
We should have like a something on the wall, and we know is Greg a Patriots fan today?
I'll always be a fan.
Yes or no?
Always.
Yeah, I don't. I don't think
the narrative is constantly changing.
Finally, in the news, the Eagles signed wide receiver Charles Johnson to a one-year deal. He's the latest or just one of many AAF players who have now found homes with NFL teams, which is a great thing because the way that league folded was a disgrace. I think we could all agree. It wasn't necessarily the fault of all the people involved with that operation, but the way it fell apart was just not fair to the players involved. So it's good to see some guys getting deals. Johnson, who was on the Orlando Apollos, led the league in receiving. He had 687 yards and 5 TDs on 45 catches in just 8 games. So that guy was balling out, as the kids say, and now he'll get a chance to stick around with the Eagles.
He's an interesting guy. There have been portions of his career where you thought with his size and athletic ability, he's got like number one receiver potential, and he's just always been injured or having run-ins with coaching staffs, or they just don't trust him, and the teams seem to move on from him pretty quickly.
Is this the same Charles Johnson?
Yeah. I mean, we've been on this guy's path for half a decade.
Former seventh-round pick of the Packers.
Incredibly underwhelmed by what he's produced.
More than 30. Yeah, he was a making the leap guy. Did we say that? Remember back in the day? That more than 30 guys from the AAF have signed, including, I think, their sack leader, Jayron Elliott. But I found it in none from the Memphis team. So terrible job by Memphis developing talent.
No, they're
no
shit. But I thought it was interesting. The Dolphins, who are, you know, in this kind of rebuild thing, they signed by far the most. They have 7 AAF players on their roster.
I think the Steelers signed 6.
Which is like, I think that's smart, actually.
Who did that? Who made those
signs? The Dolphins.
So the Dolphins did?
They're trying a little different approach.
We're hopping in the tank to talk a little AAF signings in Miami. I like it. I love it.
And they might be
more of it.
They might be onto something. That this is like, if you can hit on one or two of these guys,
or they might not be onto anything.
We'll see.
Or it's part of the organic fish tank. Let's get a bunch of guys from a lower tier of professional football and pass them off as actual top tier talent.
Out.
And go 3-13. Also a possibility. That's what's happening in the news. All right. Controversial seg, because Greg, I feel like you've had to deal with some pushback in the past from general managers and teams over an article that you write every spring.
Well, last year was the first time, and yes, it got quite a bit of pushback.
Yeah, both internally and externally, fair to say?
Well, what would the internal problems be?
Like, you know, Greg, you know, not a great job here. Could have done better work.
Yeah, Wes feels that about most of the things they produce. But other than that,
I think internally,
what?
Like most articles produced internally are like met with like a quiet
yes.
heart, basically.
Yeah, I would say internally it was met with indifference.
Yeah.
But the Bears were unhappy. Someone in the Chicago Tribune wrote a whole article about ranking Ryan Pace too low. And you know what? He then won Executive of the Year. So, egg on my face.
Does that shake your confidence a little bit going into this year's? Because it's not up on the site yet. You still have to write it.
It's coming. I have I've been working on it, but it's not coming until next week. This is more, you guys are going to, you know, we're all going to make our own.
This is a separate exercise. Greg's GM power rankings will come up down the line, but this will be our discussion about it. And I think, you know, the good way to break it down is, first of all, who are the new GMs? Because even though they've had the free agency, they haven't had a draft yet, so they get the incomplete grade. So we're going to leave out 4 or 5 teams in this conversation.
Chris Greer for the Dolphins would be one.
Right. So people like
I don't really consider him a new GM, but fair enough.
I do, because he didn't have the decision-making power, and they were pretty clear about that before, that he was kind of just there.
Brian Gutekunst is pretty new. I would put
well, we got to be going
Brandon
first guy.
Bean. It's kind of hard to judge because he was in cap hell.
Anyone that's had really less than that was hired before 2000. I mean, after the 2018, like the start of that offseason.
Got you. Yeah.
Have All you right. divided Marty Herney into 2 people, the pre-Gettleman and the post-Gettleman?
Ooh, I like that.
That's fair. All right, so let's get into it. So factoring guys that have a little bit more of runway to shape the team. Let's break it down. Let's start here, actually. Let's start with kind of the gold standard. Who are the GMs or team builders that even if they have a bad offseason, you're not shaken in their confidence? They're just guys that are kind of above even this conversation of risers and fallers and all that. Belichick, obviously,
Belichick
has to be at the top of the list.
I would put Howie Roseman in that group.
I would, too. And I would put Kevin Colbert there. And not everything he's done is perfect, but I think he has almost a 20-year track record.
To clarify, Howie Roseman of the Eagles and Kevin Colbert of the Steelers.
Right. And I think Colbert, over time, you have to kind of just trust how he's managed all the different ways of that roster. He does a really good job of kind of filling in holes that aren't even holes yet, and then they develop them, and then they have players ready to step in.
Wes, I just want to applaud you. I want to take a real quick break here to applaud the advances as a broadcaster there. That you said, I threw out some names, and most football fans are going to know which teams they were. But as a broadcaster, you said, I'm going to make sure you know that Colbert is with the Steelers.
You know, do you know what?
Know Roseman's with the Eagles.
I think
Bravo.
If we did not have a big listenership in other countries, I wouldn't do that as much. But I always think of, like, our United Kingdom fans and our European fans and our Australian, New Zealand, and Mexican and all that. That's why I do it, because I know a lot of them are new to the game.
Can you imagine, like, NBC Nightly News stopping down for, like, two reporters to compliment each other how they handled the previous segment?
Thank you for that compliment, Dan. That's better than Greg's unfair attack on what I would do with his article.
I was surprised to hear that.
I was joking. This GM ranking, who really knows? It's just entirely subjective.
Of course.
All right, here we go. So Belichick, Roseman, Colbert, we want to put anybody else in that list?
I wouldn't put him right there, but John Schneider and
Thomas Dimitroff is
those two guys I thought too.
They're hovering
right under that.
Yeah, they're hovering where
Dimitroff and who?
Schneider.
And you know what? Schneider and I'm glad you guys are really helping me do this exercise.
You mean Thomas Dimitroff of the Atlanta Falcons?
Yes.
And John Schneider of the Seattle Seahawks.
Thanks. Well done.
I really think we should just stop and talk about the, you know,
high five, Mark.
The hosting ability that Dan's really distributed. The leadership. Schneider had a really good year. I think Schneider and Carroll, you can't really separate them. You could almost put Pete Carroll right there with Schneider because you know that he's part of the personnel decisions. The fact that they were able to rebuild on the fly, and they never turned into a losing team. Like, there's this feeling, I think the 2017 Seahawks, like, totally fell apart. They went 9-7, and then they're back in the playoffs this year. So they're right there. I think Schneider is going to be moving up ahead of Dimitroff.
I would put Les Snead in this group too, personally.
I'm with you. I agree.
I don't know what more he'd need to do. They should be near the top.
They showed great patience as an organization, and see, they believed in him even when the results weren't there. And now we're going on two straight years, two NFC West titles. And I think in general, one of the things you want in a front office is you want to be able to trust the guy's vision. And I think they absolutely do. And I put him in that right below the tier.
I think also, like, you don't have the trade tsunami become anything more than just talk unless you have Les Snead being one of the guys that led the charge there. I mean, I think changed the way the GMs.
I think you're right, and it's a good question for me to have to deal with writing the rankings. Is like, how much do you knock him for the Jeff Fisher era? And essentially, is this a power ranking of where they are currently, or is it a total, like, last year? I think I looked at it because I'd never done it before and thought maybe it's a one off of their entire job, and you got to knock them a little bit for the Jeff Fisher era, but maybe Ryan Pace and Snead are an example of there's only so much you can do if the vision of your head coach and your head coach is holding the organization back. Because I think everyone who defended Ryan Pace to me a year ago saying, what could he do here with John Fox? It really isn't fair. If you kind of look at the personnel that he's actually put together, it's good. They were right. You know, but, and he was able to change on the fly, just like Snead changed on the fly once he got
my problem
coach.
With body of work, like, it certainly is a factor for your article.
Because he's been there since 2012, and they were pretty mediocre.
Right, but Les Snead should get points for evolving and changing the way that GMs, you would want your GMs.
He's a riser. He's moving up.
He's a riser. I just wonder how much of the credit should be going to McVay.
Also fair.
Yeah.
By the way, Ryan Pace dead last on Greg's rankings last year. So let's get into some risers, because I'm sure Pace has to be.
Well, he'll
rising,
be the biggest one, yeah.
For you at least,
really?
Greg. But what
the
do you
biggest think? Riser?
I mean, I guess on paper, but to me, Chris Ballard is clearly the biggest riser over the last calendar year.
What's your favorite?
That's
type
fair.
Of
I didn't even rank him because,
and I would put John Dorsey right there with him. To me, those two guys are joining. They're ready to join the upper tier.
I think that's absolutely fair. Ballard, I left off that list because a year ago, because he didn't, you know, he had 1 year of body, you know, he hadn't even gotten to his second draft at that point.
If you think about what he inherited, they can't protect Luck with that offensive line. They can't run the ball. They haven't had a 100-yard rusher in 5 years. They have no backbone on defense. This is an undisciplined, soft team with nothing in the trenches. And they are 180 degrees opposite of that.
And on top of that, the Josh McDaniels situation, the way he handled that,
yes.
The having to answer nebulous questions about Andrew Luck when your ownership is steering people in weird directions on that, and just never any drama.
Ballard might vault very high on this list, and Dorsey, I think, will be even higher. And the reason is Ballard gets a little bit of a boost, and it's not his fault, because he's only been in the league 2 years, and those 2 years have been fantastic. So you look back at Colin Kaepernick's career, or many players throughout NFL history, where through 2-3 years, they were on a trajectory to be great. But I think general managers, over time, you got to give the experience and, you know, doing it year after year after year as a bonus. And now I look back at the Chiefs' time and John Dorsey, and it's like, you kind of got to give John Dorsey maybe a little more credit than I was a year ago for what he did with the Chiefs.
Give him credit for maneuvering up to draft Patrick Mahomes for the Chiefs before he left for the Browns.
So, like, Ballard to me isn't going to get in that top five because he's only had 2 years, even though those last 2 years have been as good as anyone.
You can argue that Dorsey made the two best front office moves.
Dorsey, of course, is now the Cleveland Browns general manager. And he very used good. To be with the Kansas City Chiefs.
All right. Ryan Pace, of course, Chicago Bears.
He wears the same khakis pretty much every day and a nice
big old
brown
white
sweatshirt.
Gym shoes.
Chris Ballard of the Indianapolis Colts. But Dorsey, in moving up and making the power play to get Mahomes, and then the recent trade of Odell Beckham, are probably the two best moves any general manager has made in the last 3 years.
He's a cowboy.
Dorsey walked into a great situation, and I think that a lot of people about a year ago at this time were simply refusing to believe that John Dorsey, the experience of John Dorsey too, the baseball hat, the sweatshirt, like in theory an anti-analytics guy, which he's not. They still have D. Podesta in their building working with them, and they are listening to his. But point being, you look back at Sashi Brown's drafts, and Sashi Brown was awesome at setting the table for what came next. But his drafts and the football people in the building at that time produced very little outside of Myles Garrett, which any one of us could have made the number one pick logically. John Dorsey has brought in way more talent in a short amount of time.
His first draft was okay. It wasn't a Duke Johnson, Agba. I would say it was a B. It was a average draft, and the second one was kind of a
disaster. Duke Johnson was Ray Farmer.
Let me lay a comparison on you here. Lyndon Baines Johnson, who historians feel is underrated compared to how the general public feels about him.
Let me just jump in. Former president of the United States. Yeah. He became president when John F. Kennedy was assassinated in 1963, got elected again after.
And by the way, you're not getting
any LB. Who are we pandering to now?
Can I finish my
No.
Yeah, let us finish.
Never.
Go ahead.
So the number one job of the chief executive is to pass legislation. Lyndon Baines Johnson had the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the Revenue Act, the War on Poverty. This is getting – your job is to get things done. John Dorsey gets things done. He doesn't build huge portfolios of draft picks, and he doesn't really have – he got left all that cap space, but he converted all of it into blue-chip talent. That's your job.
So Sashi in this case is JFK.
Yes.
Well, I have some issues with all of that. I don't – like John Dorsey doesn't have like ballooning the Vietnam War into an international crisis on his resume. But other than that, yes, he did. LBJ moved a lot of things along.
Where is Sashi these days, by the way?
Sashi.
That's a great question. I mean, maybe he slipped back into the law field. I don't know.
All right. Any other risers before we move to the fallers? Any other risers going once, going twice?
Hold on. I'm at least – well, John Robinson was pretty high a year ago.
How about Tom Telesco?
But I think
I like Tom Telesco.
Yeah, he's continuing to move up. And Tom Telesco, I think, quietly has done a really good job building up that roster. And they've done it the right way, where they've really done it through the draft, and you can see the culmination of all the years that they've done on their roster.
We forgot two guys that we should put in the new category.
Okay.
Mike Mayock, of course.
Of course.
And Eric DaCosta of the Ravens taking over for Ozzie Newsome.
After what was a 25-year internship.
Yeah, it's an interesting situation because DaCosta's been very big in that organization for a long time. And the longer this goes on, the more I realize Ozzie Newsome is still kind of – he might not be the GM, but
he works for them.
He's in the DaCosta role. He was at the owners' meetings. He's at every league function. He's there at their office. So he's absolutely working, and they worked something out that, you know, he's maybe not working as hard as he used to. He's not in the top chair, but they're still like a partnership. They've just changed roles, which is a credit to them.
All right. Who's falling?
I think
Dave Gettleman.
Yeah.
Yes, Dave Gettleman.
That's one where I struggle with body of work when you have moved into what feels like painful team PR mouthpiece amidst like a rash of beguiling moves that leaves your fan base off the side of the road.
And when I when I ranked him this high, I got some pushback from Carolina people that thought Gettleman was getting too much credit.
Where did you have him last year?
He was 13th. And that he ultimately inherited all the best players on the Panthers, which is accurate. You know, they had the core of players there when Gettleman got there. And definitely his time with the Giants hasn't helped him.
I got some more followers.
Let's hear another one.
John Lynch, who to me, it would be fair to rank him number 32 right now.
Yeah, I don't even think he got ranked last year.
And 49ers,
he will be at the bottom, near the bottom of the list.
I think a classic faller on and off the field over the last year since you've done this is Cardinals GM Steve Keim.
Yeah, he's the one that struck me as a
big, what is he doing well right now?
As a big-time faller. And here's why, because when you change coaches and everything completely falls apart, to me, that's the sign of a great GM, is one that can win and do it. I gave Dimitroff a lot of credit for having two good eras, two good with different coaches that I don't think of as like the best coach in the league. Keim's kind of the opposite. He lost his coach and he fell apart.
I'm quite surprised still, and good for him. He's a man with a family and all that, but that he retained his job after the free fall of last season and the way Josh Rosen played, and internally they obviously did not love him on top of the DUI, which was bad. I'll throw it out. Got to do it. Love doing it. John Elway.
He was on my list too.
You had him ranked 7th last year, Greg, which I would have said was high last year. This year, I think he should definitely be in the 20s, perhaps, because I don't think he's done much of anything positive in recent years. Obviously, he drafted Bradley Chubb last year, but that was kind of a no-brainer, and they fell to him, so I don't give him a lot of credit for that.
I was giving him credit for all those 12-win seasons and a championship.
I get that.
Strength. He doesn't draft well. He hasn't been able to fix the quarterback. He hasn't been able to fix the offensive line. He has demonstrated that he can absolutely woo free agents.
At the time, he had been in charge of, you know, probably the third most successful NFL franchise throughout the decade, and so I was giving him some credit for that.
He's
but
a
I agree,
faller,
he was too high. No, he was way
He's
too
fallen.
High.
How about Bruce Allen?
Well, how much he can't fall too far. I think he was second to last, and he still might fall. So I think you're onto something.
I think that Dave Caldwell in Jacksonville he's been a part of drafts that have brought a lot of talent to the Jaguars. So I don't think that he's lacks skills. But I am concerned about any of these GMs that seem to be in a place where they're in a power vacuum, where they've got all these people around them that have way more power than them. And what is Dave Caldwell's say at this point inside that organization?
I got one for you guys. We did risers, we did fallers, and feel free to jump in with more fallers or even risers. But I got the Dalton line.
Okay.
Dalton scale, for new listeners, is a concept we came up with where Andy Dalton, well, West completely came up with it, is the prime meridian of quarterbacks. He is right in the middle. If your quarterback's worse than Andy Dalton, you need a franchise quarterback.
And if your GM is worse than this guy, you need a new GM. If he's better than him, you're probably in decent shape with in your front office. Jerry Jones.
I actually had this one bolded, and this is going to be kind of inside football, but I think their VP of personnel, Will McClay, it might be their acting general manager. He gets a lot of credit from
people
who follow that team as their personnel guy, and I think the Cowboys have actually built a pretty good roster.
I would not put him as the Dalton line, Dan. And I don't know who to give credit to.
Well, you're
maybe
wrong,
maybe it's Mr. Will, you know, not familiar with his work. Or it's Stephen Jones is certainly very active. I actually think as a player procurement and drafts and everything, he's been better than average for sure. They've had some shortcomings.
So is Andy Dalton.
But Jerry Jones, like,
what if Duke Tobin of the Bengals is the Dalton skip?
Are you separating the Jerry Jones that also, like, annually turns the Cowboys into the biggest marketing sensation in sports?
Yes,
this is
okay. So just in the GM, but I think that
his drafts have been really good.
But they are. I don't think they're Jerry Jones's drafts the way that they were in 2005. To Wes's point, but it's Stephen Jones too. Like they talked about over the last half decade, that a lot of that has been handed off to others inside the Cowboys.
His title is general manager.
Oh, wait.
Yes.
We've got an announcement.
Oh, wow.
I'm willing to maybe put Mr. Will's name on the GM list, maybe a slash with Stephen Jones.
He deserves it.
And then another bigger one. I'm seeing Mickey Loomis is here,
right.
Number 11 last year. That he is going to be – he might be totally replaced, but he's going to get a slash Jeff Ireland, slash Sean Payton. Maybe Loomis is just totally off the list. And it's,
that's how mine goes.
Yeah.
Loomis, Ireland, Payton.
Because at this point, I don't know. So I wanted to just point
just for bookkeeping purposes and just as you put together your piece, though, it's a bit of a slippery slope, a little bit of a Pandora's box. Once you start like divvying out who's making the decisions, you might have to do it for almost every team.
No, I don't think there's that many. You're right, there's a few. But Loomis is a particularly, as Mark loves to point out, you know, he's usually on some, you know, sales call for season tickets of the New Orleans Pelicans. I don't know how much
But then Jeff Ireland has to be a riser because his stock could not have been
right, lower
at a certain.
And Jeff Ireland and Sean Payton, you do get the, I think talking to people, you do get the sense Sean Payton has more power than most or almost any head coach. So I think Ireland and Payton are the ones really running that franchise.
I guess franchise. I just mean for the purposes of both this conversation and your article, when you start saying that Jeff Ireland is soaring up the GM power rankings when he is not, in fact, the GM,
assistant
it just
GM.
Gets a little like,
it's a tad
foggy.
Murky.
But what do you do with teams who just
all right.
use the position
Should I go?
In your head?
All right, I'm willing
and
to
we
listen.
Know they're lying to us.
How about Loomis?
Not do the segment. I don't
well,
know.
There is no official GM. I believe Loomis has a better title than that. He's like team president and consigliere and, you know, executive vice president and GM. How about Loomis slash Payton then? And Ireland's not even on there? I don't know.
You're going to have to do this with – I think there's like eight
– starting to make my head hurt.
There's like eight teams you have to do this with. The Patriots being one, Nick Caserio.
But every team, there are obviously top-of-the-line guys for every organization, but it's a collaborative effort for every team, I guess was the point I was making.
Right, that's true, because it does open it up, because John Gruden would have to get on there with the Raiders.
Sure,
there's
Mayock's
no way that Mayock has more power.
Jeff Ireland is the wind beneath the wings of Mickey Loomis.
I like that.
Jeff
Maybe
Ireland.
That's a different article.
Greg can use
an article.
The wind beneath the wings rankings.
He's had a very Rick Spielman-like comeback. So Rick Spielman's the GM of the Vikings, who left Miami. I think he's on his third team. Left Miami in ridicule in the mid-2000s. Mm. I mean, Dolphins fans
chased him out of town.
They thought he was a joke, and he's had a great run in Minnesota. Jeff Ireland similarly run out of town in Miami as a joke, and now is doing great with New Orleans. So that kind of makes you wonder – what's the real problem?
Well, it's just it's a lesson in scapegoating, because it's like you're either scapegoating the coach or the GM. It can't be one of these wind beneath the wings guys that no one's heard of. It's got to be someone who's been lashed in the press for going on months.
Spielman has built a good roster for the last half decade.
That's true. For new listeners, Wind Beneath the Wings, a very popular 1980s song sung by Bette Midler, made famous in the movie Beaches, also starring Barbara Hershey.
Greg, did they upload some information into your central processor unit? That was good. That's a lot of info beneath the wings.
Mom was a big fan. I was about 9 or 10 at the time.
Yeah, my mom, I think, had that soundtrack, as I recall.
Oh, yeah. My mom also a huge fan.
All right.
Mine, too.
You're very over today's show.
No, it's just like, okay, who – I mean
– did you just roll your
Mark
eyes?
Actually is our, Mark is already doing chores in his mind.
This is one of them.
I am not.
Yeah,
I am not.
All right, good. Can you find, Ricky, to play out today's show, we can't play the actual Wind Beneath My Wings song, but a similar equivalent in our library.
I can try.
All right, let's break down the schedule again. 2 weeks out from the draft. So next week you'll get another show on Monday and Thursday morning, because then we are on the road. We're heading south for the Chris Wessling Bachelor Party. Hope to have Connie on one of the shows next week, and we will do one of our favorite segments. You're the GM makes its return next week, so tune in for that. Twitter show Wednesday, 10:30. Pacific, 1:30 Eastern, maybe 5:30 in London. And then next, the week after that is draft week, and we're back three shows and a Twitter show. A lot of content, so Good stuff. This is Dan Hansa signing off for Quiet Storm. Listen to that. Oh, it's beautiful. The mailman, the old boss, and Ricky Hollywood behind the glass. Till Monday.